Welcome to BIOTA Live. I'm Tom Barbalay, and this is being recorded live on TalkShoe, September 4th, 2009. This is a continuation of the BIOTA podcast. For more information on the BIOTA podcast, check out biota.org/podcast. And for folks who are interested in participating, the call-in details are also available via biota.org/podcast. The next episode, Friday, 8 p.m. Pacific, September 18th, many great projects. This is a topic that's kind of been percolating for a while in terms of the number of projects that exist in the artificial life community. And speaking of the number of great projects in the artificial life community, we have Eric Burton on the line. Hello, Eric.
Hey, Tom. Sorry about that. I have this teleconference I'm three-wayed to right now. I wanted to call in and get on the thing. I've got a new long distance plan, so I can finally call in without stealing these calls.
Not a problem.
I was getting so paranoid before. I thought I should stop doing that for a while.
Don't worry about it. So the topic next, BIOTA Live, is the many great projects in the artificial life community. And I think maybe the last time we talked, you talked a little bit about your own surveying of the artificial life community's many projects. What are the projects that are exciting you currently in the artificial life community?
I've been playing with a really exciting piece of software lately, Tom, called Critterding. And they don't have a public beta of this out right now with all the new technology in it, but he's just added segmented bodies and physics with the bullet library and all kinds of new stuff like this that makes it a pretty open-ended simulation. I've been putting a few weeks into one of these just trying to get the behaviors of these things to encode the game rules in some way, but so far the brains they've evolved seem preoccupied with the physics of the place. It's pretty interesting nonetheless.
Yes, I mean, as you may have heard on the last BIOTA Live, we had Steve Grand on, and he emailed me the Symbiosis source code, as he promised to do. I've had a look through it, and it's absolutely fascinating. And I think for someone such as yourself, you'd be ideally suited to look through the code too. I mean, as I was doing with Jeffrey Ventrella, the project really associated with getting these folk to move their closed source projects open source, so people such as yourself and other people in the broader artificial life community can look at it and can collaborate and possibly merge projects is the reason why I'm doing this. And really, it's a question out to the community where we go from here. I think Steve is interested in thinking about open source and thinking about moving it open source. It could be something that moves in a number of different directions. Obviously, my interest is contributing it to the artificial life community, similar to a wide variety of other open source projects. We have Eric Burton back on the line.
Well, yeah, this is a neural net application, and I'm hoping they can get it out on for everyone to use soon, because there were some optical character recognition tests that it passed with flying colors, and in theory, these things have got this visual retina. You should be able to learn to see in their environment, and when it has 3D features and things like this, you should be able to get a whole variety of life forms if we can get the cycles together. He just started experimenting with these closed races, like in Framsticks, to evolve for properties of the phenotypes and et cetera.
Wonderful. Now, we have Bruce Tamer on the line as well, and I know Eric has been a huge fan of the EvoGrid development. Bruce, it's wonderful to have you on BIOTA Live this evening.
My pleasure, Tom.
So, Eric, as we have the benefit of Bruce on the line, what's your current thinking with regards to the EvoGrid, and what questions do you have for Bruce specifically about the EvoGrid?
I still think that's an exciting project. You know, I'm not real sure how you're gonna have an algorithm in there looking for reproducibility or actual reproduction or copying within the soup. If you could get one, I can see how you could send up some kind of an alarm the first time some node found anything reproducing, and that's a good task to distribute among many machines, and then you, of course, you could feed the ones that are reproducing onto all the machines and try to work on algorithms that would select ones that show more interesting behaviors than that up the ladder. Ultimately, I think you need an artificial intelligence to select them.
Eric, this is you bring up a whole range of really interesting questions. Dick Gordon talks about the origin of perception and that perception is half the story. And one of the things, just to sort of clarify, in the very beginning days or years of the evil grid, we're not going to see anything near replication or reproduction. We're going to just see a whole bunch of things forming structures and forming patterns of reactions or cycles of reactions. And that it's prebiotic in a sense, or pre-artificially biotic.
Sure.
So when we actually see things making copies, kind of if we see a tiara, if we see tiara spontaneously emerge within the evil grid, it will be a major achievement.
Dawkins' prebiotic replicators were just crystals that would fracture at a certain length and form the stable-sized crystals again.
Yeah, and certainly, if one decided to set up the experiment so that replication happens, replication will happen.
Right.
The tricky knife edge or the razor's edge here is, if you set it up to happen, it's likely to happen so well that it reaches the complexity threshold and never goes beyond, which was the challenge of Tierra, that it never busted through that plateau and went further. And it's almost like you need a much more complex open-ended system to get that kind of behavior. You need your primordial soup almost.
Indeed.
And you're traveling to Scandinavia in the near future, Bruce, aren't you, in order to talk about these things and also what's going to happen at Artificial Life 12?
Yeah, I'm scheduled now to go. I'm going to London on the 15th of October and then hopefully meeting Martin Hanzig and going to Copenhagen to take the train down to Odense. And on Friday the 16th, meet all day with himself and Harald Sellerman and Steen Rasmussen. It's likely that I'll be one of several people organizing a track at the conference about these kind of simulations that are used in context with origin of life research, and which is very exciting to me. I mean, it's going to be, I put on that hat with relish and really look forward to interacting with the community, especially if papers are being submitted and we're trying to decide if it's a whole track, then we've got, you know, a couple of days to fill of theme papers. It's a wonderful, generous invitation by Steen, someone who's relatively unknown to the A-Life academic community, to let me be participating.
And I think, I mean, certainly the surveying that we're getting currently is that there could actually be a suite of applications which, I don't know whether you call them EvoGrid-like applications. I don't know whether you call them all part of the EvoGrid. I'm not sure how you do this. As I was saying to Eric prior to you getting on the call, Steve Grand emailed me his symbiosis source through the week. And it's fascinating because obviously part of this project with Steve Grand and also with Jeffrey Ventrella in terms of moving a lot of their legacy source code open source is really about kind of sparking a broader artificial life community, which Eric is central in terms of those that actually pick up this source code, manipulate it, and perhaps create, you know, future collaborations from it. So, I mean, as you phrase the EvoGrid going into your discussions with regards to A-Life 12, Bruce, do you see it as being a suite of possible projects? Do you see it as being your specific EvoGrid and then a series of EvoGrid-like projects? How do you put that all together?
I think that what I'm after is a kind of a holy grail of a method. So it's very much like our call with Steve Grand a couple of weeks ago along those lines. In fact, the dissertation that I'll be writing as a result of this work is going to be the EvoGrid you know, a generalized architecture for doing a whole class of research around emergent complexity. So evil grids of all types could be built with this idea, and I think Eric pretty much summarized it, is that you've got an engine that is doing a physics and is doing a toy universe, and then you have other lookers or seekers that are trying to find complexity within that universe, and then targeting, then reporting back, and then some kind of tracker is looking at allocating more computing resources or taking various shortcuts without necessarily without biasing the simulation unduly. I.e., that there's no intelligent, there's algorithms that are selecting, but is, you know, the key question is that artificial evolution or artificial simulation of complexity. Well, of course, it's all artificial, but really the end result is, if you get a piece of molecular or algorithmic machinery that occurs with years and years of running this, and you can absolutely say no one built this, and this went through several levels of complexity. It's not only is there algorithmic machinery at one level, but there's machinery below, and there's entire sort of an artificial ecosystem. You can say, well, maybe the whole thing was a setup, but look at this. We know that no one made this thing, and it did emerge from the ground up, so to speak, with a whole lot of tweaking, which is what chemists are doing all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm writing a chapter currently on this idea of actually searching for artificial life in noise and what kind of properties one looks for when one writes the algorithms to actually search these things out. And I think in all the test algorithms I can find, and they're all fundamentally based on cellular automata, be that chemical automata and what have you, there's a kind of crunchiness to the complexity of what you see in artificial life. I mean, if you look at, you know, Conway's life, for example, the structures that are formed and the structures that are formed in cellular automata have a kind of a complexity which is relatively easy to follow algorithmically. So I think it's one of these things which what we're lacking currently is just papers written about this very subject. And certainly I'll be talking to Mark Badeau within the next month, and I'll put to him that one of the areas of research that could be very easily kind of tackled is this whole idea of scanning algorithmically through an artificial world, through some kind of simulated soup in order to find the areas of interest. I think it's relatively trivial with your eyes, and this is the beauty of Dick Gordon's observer function, because that's exactly what you're trying to do algorithmically, is just look for that kind of crunchiness, which is fundamentally either pre or just at the cusp of the formation of artificial life. But I'm still going through the news and notes. We haven't actually touched on this evening's topic yet. So I wanted to send a shout-out to Duncan, who's a listener of the Biota podcasts, who I've been communicating with for a couple of years now. He lives in San Diego, and he's one of these, I don't know what you would call them now, kind of bio farmer folk who is part of an independent startup who has a long-term interest in artificial life, but he also, as an evening project, creates servo switches and other kind of robotics-like things for model railways, but he's the perfect kind of crossover with regards to the robotics community and the ALife community. So I picked his brain over dinner about some of his listening habits associated with podcasts, what he liked in Biota Live, but also about this business that he's creating, because I think this is certainly the model that we were discussing over the past two Biota Lives in terms of artificial life developers developing an after-hours project in terms of selling little bits of hardware. And he has some wonderful YouTube clips associated with this kind of single circuit board servo arrangement, which is very much the model of what I was discussing with Steve Grand last week, and also Tolkis, both the Biota Live before and the last Biota Live. So shout out to Duncan, also to Ian Woodward, whose question came via Facebook, but then I posted through the EvoGrid mailing list and then posted back to him on Facebook. So if you want to get in contact and you listen to Biota Live and you want to phrase any questions, please email them to me either via my regular email, tom@noble8.com, or via Facebook or via Twitter or via any of these mechanisms. I'll put it back to the artificial life community and then get you the answers back, or even better, consider joining the Biota Conversations mailing list or the EvoGrid mailing list. So I think I've pretty well covered the news and notes. So this week's topic, we're going to be exploring some of the aspects of the singularity. Eric, as you follow the artificial life community and a wide variety of other kind of emerging tech communities, what's your view with regards to the singularity movement?
Well, you know, Tom, I want to say heuristics can take us so far, but I always end up wishing I had an AI to tune these GAs, and then it occurs to me if I had an AI, it could just design the most interesting organism possible for the model I'm working with to short-circuit the whole process, which is really why I'm interested in the singularity community as well, because I think if they can deliver human-level AI, then they can produce an unlimited stream of interested customers for technology services, which would be a boom for the high-tech industry, which is certainly our future, and that would help every city on Earth.
I have to agree with you. I mean, that's the utopian vision associated with the singularity movement, and it was interesting having Steve Grand on.
To a day trade to pay for cloud time and storage.
Certainly.
So they could pursue their interests.
Well, when you posted that in the Biota Conversation, ironically, I know a couple in Las Vegas who have done exactly that and approached me, and I'm in some ongoing communication with their. They have a group called the Las Vegas Futurists here, and that's basically what they do. They have an extended algorithm that they've been working on for the past 15 years that basically does that, that manages hedge funds and does a wide variety of other financial trading-related things, and they've made themselves quite a bit of money through it.
I did a little trading work with a GA in the neural net. It's theoretically sound, and it's not that difficult.
Certainly. Well, it's a principle that they use, and they have been talking to me about releasing components of their algorithm open source, if nothing more, so they can get a greater degree of academic credibility associated with the field. But they are, it's funny because certainly we share a number of mutual friends. In fact, I think they're mutual friends with Bruce as well, which is probably how I was introduced to them, perhaps by John Smart or someone else. But what's interesting with the singularity community is you're right in terms of the vision, and you're right in terms of the people that get interested as active participants. What interested me with Steve Grand on Last Bite Live was he used the very pure definition of artificial life as it could be. And what interested me also is that he said that artificial intelligence was a subset of artificial life. And that interests me as well because that's the definition of intelligence as it could be, which is ultimately my argument with regards to us being fundamentally post-singular, is that you need to remove the idea of intelligence from human intelligence, just as we've removed the idea of life and biological life in terms of what we do with artificial life. So my argument has been, you know, for a few years now, that we should think of ourselves as being post-singular in terms of the fact that we are surrounded by systems which are far better at surviving than we are, and perhaps survival is a far better initial metric of intelligence. I mean, you can build human intelligence from survival. You can build a wide variety of intelligences from survival. Right. But what has interested me is this kind of broad changing movement associated with the singularity, which Bruce touched on when he was last on Biota Live. Can you talk a little bit more, Bruce, about the kind of changing direction and perhaps some of the underlying politics associated with the breakaway groups from the singularity? And how does it all fit together as you see it?
Well, you know, frankly, I'm not that connected with the community. I was at the Singularity University. I did a talk in July, and I went to the graduation last week. But I think that they're really, and two of the Singularity University people came here to a party we had here on Wednesday night. I don't think anybody really knows what singularity means. I think it's one of those, it's like AI or other things in technology, sort of a technosis type of thing where everybody has their own idea. They're walking around in their head with their own idea what it's about. You know, for me, it's a science fiction idea that's still in science fiction. But, you know,
the singularity is like the point when AI starts to give us technology we couldn't have had without time travel or Congress with aliens. You know? Mm-hmm. One that starts to print out future technology designs extrapolated from faithful simulations of Earth physics, that would be what we call the singularity. There would be an accelerating payoff at that point where the designs would be from 10 years in the future, then 100, then 1,000 as we implemented them and used them to produce new ones. And it would be a matter of how quickly we made use of the stuff coming down the pipe.
When I hear about that, I it's almost like going back to the artificial intelligence days. How do you get there from here? And I had a lunch. About 6 or 7 years ago, I had lunch. Gail and I had lunch with John McCarthy. Was it John McCarthy? Gosh, I guess it was. No, it was the fellow from the East Coast.
Anyway, you had lunch with someone.
Anyway, and he said he was incredibly disappointed by the whole thing, that it had, that's the how you get there from here. He felt there'd been no progress in the 50 years that he'd been working, 45 years he'd been working in it, and he was fed up with it.
Which is just the nature of the problem of looking at a very finite thing and not being able to solve a very small thing and not looking at the broader kind of complexity and wonder that comes through things like, you know, the internet or, you know, a wide variety of other complex systems which are in fact far broader than the individual humans that are constructing them. I think there's an issue associated with localized intelligence that I heard recently attached to someone, and I think this is the same problem that we're very good at this idea of kind of localized intelligence, and we're very good at focusing that. But in terms of broader intelligence, we've really failed in order of kind of grasping the magnitude and the complexity of the systems that we create. And that seems to be the fundamental disconnect with this idea of kind of human intelligence and singularity. And I think this is what's beautiful with regards to Eric's vision associated with the fact that we probably do have this pipeline in terms of things that are being produced almost like they were from alien intelligence. I mean, Eric, how do you see the present day versus this narrative?
Well, I think it would be the most disruptive technology in the world, Tom. I mean, the first things we would get would be nano fabricators and teleportation technology, faster than light radio and things like this, and we'd be immediately converted to a star-going civilization. There wouldn't be a limit on the progress we could make from there. It would just be a matter of how much of human identity we felt was our responsibility to keep, I think, how many identificatory traits.
So this is basically breaking the energy barrier, but breaking entropy and being able to create things that were far greater than anything we could have originally imagined.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a potential outcome for life on Earth, I imagine, for intelligent life anywhere. I've read that single planet species have a statistically low survival rate, but we have a lot of resources on Earth and we're rich in some ways. So one of those ways may turn out to be in research and information technology. That may be what saves us in the end. It may do so in dramatic fashion.
Oh, I'll just jump in here a bit. I'm a huge skeptic about this kind of thing. Kind of what Eric Davis called technosis, which is, in a sense, you know, I don't know whether he said this or somebody else said this, it's the rapture for nerds.
Right.
Because, as you might know, Eric, I've been in the computing since the 70s, but in, you know, sort of as a standoffish kid and then really getting involved about 1981. But in the barn, I've got a giant collection of vintage computers, and I've got machines, operating machines from the year of my birth, from 1962 on up.
Right.
And I can track all that. And to tell you the truth, and there's a second part of things, and I've been working with NASA for 10 years and sort of following it since I was a kid in the 60s.
Yeah.
And to tell you the truth, I think that human beings, I would more bend toward Tom's approach, I think, which is, I don't think that we're going to see some kind of singular intelligent thing that wakes up one day and starts inventing technology for us and going to Starbucks and having a coffee with us. I think that we are being absorbed into a big, complex thing that we're having to maintain. and that it's taking more and more of our attention. And then that thing is a huge collective mass thing. It's right. Not an intelligence. It's a movement. Well, giving an example of where that thing takes you, Skylab, which was launched in 73.
You need more human input, not less.
Well, let me finish.
Okay.
Skylab, I've been involved in NASA for about a decade, but I've studied and we've modeled almost every single mission NASA has done, human and robotic. Skylab was launched in 1973. It was a very fairly simple space station. It was fairly large because they used the Saturn V, the last remaining Saturn V. But it was very low maintenance. The International Space Station, on the other hand, is incredibly complex. Software runs every aspect. It can actually be operated from the ground with no crew on board. It's never been done, really, but they designed it that way. But it requires a huge amount of crew, constant crew maintenance, and things are breaking and whatnot.
Yeah.
And there's now 6 to 12 people there off and on. But what that points out is, and this is what I pointed out to two people from the Singularity Program who came here 2 days ago, said you're living in an ever more complex machine that isn't necessarily very well designed. It gradually gets optimized over time as society spends more and more mental resources on this thing. But I don't know if there's any direction to it. I mean, certainly it enables commerce and enables science and whatnot, sort of accelerates life, but I think it's just this big cooperative, collective bargain that we've all gotten into. And I think, Tom, you pointed out in the past that the singularity is happening, but it's this big, massive hydra that we're being engulfed in.
And I think what comes through your discussion is the fragility of the human body, but in fact the persistence of the human mind in some very real sense. And I mean, I don't want to necessarily get dualistic here, but the issue with regards to how we will, the benefits that we've made through space exploration where we haven't had to put our bodies into space, particularly with regards to Mars, particularly with regards to how these robotic entities on Mars, even while their wheels kind of break off or stop functioning, can continue to give us worthwhile information. And this kind of feedback is really, you know, moving beyond our bodies in terms of what we are dealing with. I mean, the nature of the problems associated with putting humans in space is always to do with our bodies and there's fundamental flaws in this, but our minds seem to be considerably freer in terms of how they can interact with these kind of environments. I mean, what interested me with regards to this evening's topic was this idea of the Singularity Summit. And I think the description that you gave last time you were on Biota Live is really that the singularity movement is now fracturing in a number of different directions that are, in many regards, away from Kurzweil and Bernardini's original vision associated with, you know, this very tight singularity. And what interests me is that they still have a summit where they bring back together all the old names to continue to talk about the narrative, but there doesn't seem to be any kind of progression within the core group that still consider themselves, you know, the original visionaries of the singularity. And what interests me is the almost 1950s-style sci-fi methodology that goes into this movement. But what Eric talks about is the extreme kind of inspiration that this idea, when taken by independent folk thinking about it, can give, you know, new and interesting visions. And I'm certainly always positive towards these ideas as kind of motivators. My real concern with regards to the singularity kind of TM movement is this idea that there are, in fact, a number of intellectually regressive forces that are polluting the discussion, and really it would be far better to have folks such as, you know, Eric and yourself and myself and people that are actively doing real development in these areas talking about it, as opposed to the same old folk who kind of come out and say the same kind of 1950s sci-fi vision associated with this thing. And whilst we can all do what we do and do it independently, it just seems to be almost a kind of digressive force associated with the contemporary singularity movement, which is what interested me about this idea of breakaway components that are actually reaching out to people such as yourself, Bruce. I mean, is this what you're feeling currently?
Well, yeah. This summer, for instance, the Singularity Program, I agreed to participate and present on the condition that there wouldn't be an overarching requirement to talk about Ray and Verner's science fiction vision of the singularity that I could actually just present the evil grid and present the history of computing. Several of the students that were at graduation came up and said it was just that they really liked the talk, and they got a lot out of it. And each of the presenters, I don't think that many of them really even talked about it. The day that I was there, nobody mentioned the word singularity who was presenting. So it seemed to be just, and on Wednesday night, one of the organizers was here, and I said, you know, the problem is, and maybe you guys have thought about this, is the word singularity is now so culturally loaded in a very small, and he said, yeah, and it is, and it's in a very small nerd community, but it's culturally loaded already, and it's in a sense polluted by that. There were people who wouldn't participate in the program because it had had singularity on it, who wouldn't present because they thought it was flaky. And so I said, is there any possible, the program didn't seem to have a whole lot to do with the singularity idea. It was just a whole bunch of cool topics and nice speakers and students doing green earth kind of energy projects. They're creating these companies. They were forming companies that would help humanity to do certain things like fabricating buildings using something that looked like a giant plotter. And they'd come up with some ideas, not one of which had anything to do with the singularity as a pop fiction idea. So I said, really, you're not doing anything with the singularity. You may as well rename this something else. Because it's a grab, you're really doing a really good grab bag program of good thinkers and speakers and good students, and that it isn't singularity at all.
Well, how about the Institute for the Future or something like that? I mean, there are a wide variety of ways they could say what they wanted to say without using the singularity term.
Eric, you had something.
What's that, Bruce?
You had something to add there?
I was saying the Tavistock Institute is a think tank for the future.
Yeah, there's many of these, and when this was proposed about a year and a half or 2 years ago, I said to the people, "Do you really want to use this term?" Because in a sense, between Ray, Ray was publicly admonished, and about 3 or 4 years ago, he was presenting his singularity curves going to infinity and machine intelligence walking at Stanford, and he got really dragged over the coals because the academics invited him to come down and say, okay, we're computer scientists. You're an engineer. You're a technologist. We don't believe you have, you know, you haven't even started to say, how do you get from A to B? How do you make, you know, technology isn't really moving in the direction, you know, certainly processor speeds are getting faster. And I provided Ray the data.
Then it said by 2030, well, singularity, and then IBM said in 2018 you can make a brain equivalent device from their hardware. About a year later.
Well, that was being said in the 60s, about the 80s. So I don't think if we don't understand what consciousness is, and we don't
Eric,
this is right.
Certainly. So I mean, to round up this, the group that I've had some contact with is, I mean, I've had contact with folks in the singularity community as well, and I've never actually had the opportunity to say this on Bios Live, but I did invite a wide variety of folks from the singularity community onto this evening's discussion. And we have assembled a group of folks who aren't part of that community. But the thing that interested me initially was the A Prize from the Lifeboat Foundation. And these are folk in the, I think they're a kind of singularity breakaway group, but they certainly say that they're part of the broader singularity community, and they are actively collecting money associated with an artificial life prize. So anyway, as I was saying, I had some correspondence with Project Lifeboat last year, in April last year, with regards to getting them on Bios Live and actually talking about their a prize. And we've had some discussion in the past associated with this whole idea of prizes. I always return to the notion of children's charities, that if children's charities were run similar to these artificial life prizes, you'd have, a truck turning up at a remote village in Peru with a kind of back filled with cash and having children running for the truck. And the first child to actually reach the truck would get all the money, which seems to be the whole notion associated with these A-Life prizes. So I'm always a bit concerned when I hear about charitable artificial life prizes that are awarded to a single participant. But I wanted to have the Lifeboat Foundation folk on to talk about their A-Prize. And as my experience has been with regards to a few folk in the Singularity community, they asked for the questions up front, and I asked for broad questions associated with artificial life, and they decided not to come on. They say on their site that they've generated $28,000, but if you actually look at the fine print, they have about $3,000 worth, and the remaining is promised to them but hasn't yet been paid. In terms of these groups actually kind of collecting money for artificial life prizes or talking about their representations of the artificial life community without actually having connections with the International Society for Artificial Life or really anyone that, you know, we can track in the artificial life community. I mean, do you have concerns associated with this, Bruce?
Well, I think I met one fellow who had, maybe he was the sponsor of the A Prize. There was Brig Kleiss who had also sponsored a prize. I'm not sure who we're talking about here. I'm trying to put it together in my head.
The Lifeboat Foundation, the fellow I was speaking to was a fellow called Matt McGrill, and he's a system engineer at Juniper Networks. I mean, he's just like the rest of us who has a day job. But he was the representative that they'd connected with who was going to talk on Bios Live, and he asked for the questions and then stopped corresponding relatively hurriedly when I sent him back a list of questions asking not necessarily specifics associated with artificial life, but just the general methodology associated with awarding the prize to a single project and the kind of guidelines that they were going to use with regards to the project selection. Similarly, I referenced the Brig Kleiss interview because I think that was a very, I mean, I've gotten a lot of feedback, including from Brig himself, that was a very fair interview associated with something that I'm relatively ethically challenged about in terms of awarding single prizes to artificial life projects or whether these prizes are really just a better, you know, motivation for publicising the people that are giving the prizes as opposed to the broader artificial life community, which has been another one of my concerns. But in terms of Project Lifeboats, they are, well, I mean, they claim to be collecting money. There was $1,000 that was donated initially from the Lifeboat Foundation, and then probably another $2,500 that they've actually collected. There's, like I said, about $25,000 has been promised to them. It hasn't been collected in the 2 or 3 years that they've been operating. My concern is just that they're claiming to represent artificial life attached to the singularity, and they don't seem to really have any connection with artificial life, but they're using the term and doing a lot of publicity associated with it.
Yeah, again, as you pointed out, artificial life is being pulled in different directions. Craig Venter uses the term to talk about, you know, pulling nuclei out of one cell and putting it into another and putting widgets in there and creating something, sort of hacking existing biology.
Yeah.
And then there's wet A life and there's soft A life of the 90s period. And so the term is being pushed and pulled and shoved and we, you know, the prize seekers have their own idea of what it means. And that, as you pointed out also, the Wikipedia entry keeps changing too, and it doesn't really represent the field. So in some sense, because there isn't sort of an institute of artificial life, you know, perhaps the Santa Fe Institute provided that for several years, but there isn't a body, really. I mean, I guess there's the...
I think of the International Society for Artificial Life, headed by Mark Badeau, that has had kind of semi-democratic elections, that have had a number of former participants in Bios Live, some who got on the board, some who didn't in the recent elections. I think the International Society is probably the best gauge for contemporary artificial life in terms of... Does that seem fair?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You reminded me of that. And I think I'm going to be in a really good position to understand the community after being part of the organizing committee for Artificial Life 12. I'm really hoping to gain insight, better insights, so I can actually talk intelligently.
So certainly. And Eric, I know you have to leave the call relatively quickly, but do you have any kind of closing comments associated with this topic?
No, I'm just glad I got in a few words, Tom, you know, in defense of the singularity and everything. I'm pretty sure we'll probably have some kind of a payoff from A-Life or AI pretty soon that's more than people could do, I think.
Certainly I don't think Bruce and I are necessarily talking against that. I think we all have collective visions associated with how that's going to happen. And I think certainly as an inspirational vehicle, and this is something that you've touched on, this is very important with regards to the singularity, but I think also broader science fiction in general. I mean, what we should be doing is not only reading science fiction, but also contributing back to the science fiction community. Do you think that's a fair assessment, Eric?
Yeah, no, definitely. If we can, you look at Greg Egan, you know, he takes a lot. He's like the Michael Crichton of information technologies. He takes a lot of cutting-edge information technologies and, like, really makes them far out for his stories about the not-so-distant future, and it's pretty compelling stuff.
Certainly. Well, Eric, it's always a pleasure to have you on, and I look forward to your further contribution both via audio and via the chat. I know you have to go. Always a pleasure, Eric. You take care.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Eric.
We have William R. Buckley on the line. Hello, William.
Hello, how are you doing, Tom?
Very good, very good.
So is the topic something about economics?
The topic is, this has been an ongoing discussion, and certainly having met with Duncan for dinner, the topic associated with how the economy will affect artificial life, whether we will go underground, whether we will start writing, whether this is going to affect anything, or whether we basically have all learnt from the past 20 years' worth of ebbs and flows.
Oh, come on. You think human nature is going to change?
I'm not making any claims with regards to human nature. I'm talking about the individuals associated with artificial life. I think we're all, well, certainly, I mean, you talk to folks such as Steve Grand, we've all had a collective group of experiences which make us considerably more robust in these circumstances where we, you know, seem to ebb and flow between jobs.
I don't believe that economics and my ability to feed myself has anything to do with my emotional attachment to artificial life as a field or any other piece of work that I do. I think those are completely disconnected, at least in the mind of a true believer.
Very true. Testified.
You are.
And as you walk into this temple, Bruce, I mean, are you following Brother William?
Yeah, I think we could be classified as insane people.
That's how you get ahead. That's how you accomplish goals. You can't be dissuaded by, you know, walls, bricks, naysayers, all kinds of negative influence. You've got to go for it, and it doesn't really matter what anybody else says.
Very much so. Just with regards to the last topic, you mentioned that you yourself were considering offering a prize associated with artificial life at some time. Do you want to recount that story?
I had suggested to a couple of people that I would be willing, at least at some point, to start off to bankroll, provide a seed fund that would be useful to promote developments in developmental systems. I'm interested in machines that develop. You know, that's the shtick I'm captured by, and no one else seems to do much work in that area, at least realization models.
So that was sort of the suggestion,
and nothing's happened. I haven't heard back from them. I don't know if they're afraid of I want to call it the John Maynard Smith Prize, but they apparently don't like that idea.
And how would this work? I mean, what are the parameters, what are the conditions, and how many people would actually be awarded the prize?
Some paper that would be awarded by the ISAL board or whoever's running the conference or whatever for, you know, $500, $1,000 for a paper that addresses this issue. The best paper at the conference that addresses this issue. You know, and once you start, look, let me tell you the truth. I've been a grad student in computer science. I've looked for scholarships. Guess how many there are? Something like zero. You got to be in other fields to get a scholarship in you know, to get to go to school. It doesn't work like that. Not for computer science. No one endows it. Somebody's got to. You know, and if it can't be someone like Larry Ellison with billions of dollars, then you got to do it some other place. And it doesn't seem to be all that much money for $500 or $1,000 every couple of years at a conference to provide a, you know, a stipend for someone who's written a decent paper.
So, Bruce, what do you think the challenges for this kind of prize are?
I'm mainly definitional. Well, Brigg was interesting. Brigg and I had a long conversation about 3 or 4 years ago, and his whole thing was that there are prizes that are very political, and he felt that the Nobel Prize and et cetera, were dependent on people and connections and influence and whose advisor was yours, and who do you know. And then there are prizes which are objective. And by the way, there's a lot of noise.
You know, we have Rudolf Penikov on the line as well, so I'll phrase the question to him too. I mean, as you look at artificial life currently, what kind of prizes would you like to see, and what would you like to see them for?
That meant to go to Rudolf or William?
Rudolf, are you there?
Rudolf.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think one of the problems is that these projects, they should be quite large projects, such as the EvoGrid and like this. These projects are being considered to universities. There are a number of universities already offering artificial intelligence programs. And let's have these students and the people who are doing the research there, let's have them develop programs that make this kind of software more lifelike. And
sorry, Rudolf, your audio is coming through very poorly, and we've had problems in the past. So I'm going to have to cut you off and probably take you off the call because it's giving us a lot of feedback. But I mean, Please do participate in the chat. Sorry about that for the other participants. So I think Rudolf's point was fundamentally that researchers need to be allowed to do research, and by putting out a prize, and particularly a prize that is skewed in some regard, I think what was interesting with Brigg Kleis's prize was that there was the potential to actually do a lot of very broad research, irrespective of whether or not you agreed with Brigg. And it could fit into a wide variety of possible projects. My concern with regards to more focused prizes is firstly, is that the nature of what artificial life is doing currently? And that's what interested me with regards to your potential prize, William, was this idea of your own particular interest. And I agree, it is a good subset of artificial life. But is that really the kind of thing that should be putting money into the community? More importantly, even if it's, $500 or $1,000. Sorry?
It's really simple. You can choose anything you want. It's all arbitrary. It doesn't really matter what you support. Choose one thing. Once you choose one thing, you've created an example. Until you have an example, no one else wants to follow suit. Everybody's happy with the status quo. That's why nothing ever gets done. Too much lollygagging, too much resting on laurels, and all of the rest of that crap. It's really simple.
Certainly. And I think, you have two people that agree with you in terms of Bruce and myself on the call.
Yeah, I understand that. But, there's plenty of other people. Let me tell you something. I heard this from a politician once, from a U.S. congressman. He told me that when a constituent calls to complain, they assume there are 10,000 others with that same complaint because 99 of them won't call. it takes a lot of chutzpah to call up and complain. Most people don't. They just go home. That's why our society is in the condition it's in today. You don't have enough people demanding quality results. They're having to take less than quality results. Look at the home that you buy. Go out and look at any new home, you know, built in the local track, and the quality of the wall and so forth, and how flat and straight it is. Come on. Average person just buys anything. It takes a lot of chutzpah to complain.
But as we are all actively passionate about artificial life, I mean, as you say, in order to get on Bios Live, you need to have a lot of chutzpah. And that has certainly come through in this evening's call. So as you come on Bios Live, I mean, this is the question with regards to prizes. Isn't it better just to create an active talking community where you can bring in people such as, you know, Eric Burton, you can bring in people such as Tolkis and Steve Grand and Bruce and Gerald and all the folk that call into Bios Live? And, I mean, isn't that the important thing? Isn't the communication the important part as opposed to, you know, dangling carrots associated with specific areas? I mean,
No. Hell no, in fact. The fact is that all of the talk and so forth can occur right alongside of a prize, and there's nothing wrong with promoting development in some particular area. For instance, the United States government does it all the time through their DARPA and ARPA and whatever other kind of acronym you've got attached to it these days. And they have all kinds of interesting products come out of it, including the Internet.
But that's not a prize. That's research funding.
Hold it. They paid money to get those things. It's the same thing as a prize.
No.
It's inducement. All you're doing is providing somebody with a source of income and a means thereby to pursue some particular act of excellence that attracts them. And for the people who work for DARPA or so forth, they happen to be attracted by those particular prizes. It's simple. That's how humans work.
I understand that. I understand that with regards to research funding. There's a great distinction with regards to research funding and a prize, though.
I don't see any distinction. It's money for work, period.
Well, one is money for work that you get prior to doing the work, and one is money for work that you may get at the conclusion of the work. That's the distinction.
You may get. What do you mean you may get?
Well, that's the nature of a prize. You attribute a set of things, and then you let an external body assess what you have done together with a wide variety of other folks.
So you're worried about someone else judging the merit of the work.
Well,
I thought that was the whole basis of, you know, getting into publications as well, is the merit of the work, based on the view of your peers or some...
True.
Select group of them.
But they don't just publish one paper. They publish a suite of papers, and there are conditions and discussions that go on related to that. The problem with the idea of the contemporary prize is that you have, firstly, a group that's actively promoting the prize, so they get the publicity, the interest, and also the speaking point associated with that. And then you have an independent group of very quiet, oftentimes silent entities that are moving towards that prize, probably doing amazing research in their own particular fields. But of that group, only one is selected, if they are selected. And the problem with contemporary technology prizes is they're rarely selected. The money rarely is awarded in contemporary technology prizes. Instead, it's a vehicle in order to motivate publicity for the people that are giving the money, in theory.
Oh, you're concerned about whether the funding I might supply would end up as advertising media for the powers of ISAL instead of those who actually produced the written work for which the prize was intended for award.
Well,
you're talking about moving my money from one place to another. I don't think it would occur. First off, that would qualify as fraud. Come on.
Well, that's the nature of these prizes as they've been offered. That's the nature of these prizes as they've been offered. They don't get awarded. Brigklaus did not award his prize. He has not awarded his prize.
No.
And if you talk to him about the terms of his prize, it's not clear whether you get $2,000 or $100,000. So the examples associated with artificial life, as you describe them, are as you describe them, and I don't want to necessarily use... Negative.
Use my words. I've been very plain. Do the same yourself.
So let's just say that I agree with you in the ideal form. I mean, this is the way it should occur. Unfortunately, it just hasn't occurred that way to date associated with artificial life and related technology prizes.
If that's the case, then maybe you should consider Brig Kleiss's thing to be perhaps a little fraudulent, perhaps a little disingenuous.
Can I jump in here?
Go ahead.
Just before we slander people.
It's not slander to suggest it might be. And to think about it is not slander.
Let me shift this just slightly. I think that perhaps...
I've been in the journalism business. I know.
Well...
Continue, Bruce.
Let's shift this to a more positive bent, and possibly a way forward, which is prizes are... There's components to them. And one of the best motivators that I've seen in the last few years is the idea of challenges. You know, the UK has its 6 grand challenges in science, and basically a group came together and said, you know, what are the hardest, most interesting problems to pose? And they created challenges, and those created the core for whole sets of funding in UK research. But, for instance, the EvoGrid itself, I'm framing an architecture that is designed to meet the challenge of autonomous multi-complexification emergence. And that really is what it is. It's a challenge. And say, I have no idea if I can meet that challenge. And there's no prize at the end other than saying it's a cool idea and we could work on it. Challenges tend to be not divisive. They tend to be just, well, people are attracted to the idea and think, yes, some people should be working on it. So in a sense, shift from prize to challenge and then frame and crystal clear describe these challenges. Get people excited about them. They can work on it on their own way, and maybe you get all the benefits of the beneficial parts of prizes without all the rigmarole.
And you also actively promote the participants within a challenge as well. This is my other concern with prizes, is that it doesn't show a community. It doesn't echo a community. The A prize doesn't echo the artificial life community. It doesn't show the energies and the motivations and all the people that are involved. Whereas I think what Bruce is doing with the EvoGrid, as he describes it, is presenting a challenge, and then all the folks that come through, be it Steve Grand, be it Scott Schaefer, be it all the participants that have expressed an interest in creating their own visions of the EvoGrid, can create that and be promoted through this idea of the challenge versus the prize. Does this make sense to you, William?
Well, semantics, I think, in this particular case, challenge, prize, call it whatever you will, a little bit of support that ends up promoting someone enough, prompting them enough to actually produce a little bit of work, to compete for it, is probably not a bad thing. Competition is sort of the central element of, the capitalist world, and a lot of people seem to think that works real well. I don't think that there is anything wrong with prompting people, giving people a little bit of a challenge to strive for, and if it's all in good fun, that's one thing. Everybody benefits from it. There's nothing wrong with a nominal amount of money. If there are problems with commitment to delivering on a prize or otherwise, that's an issue that I would look at in different terms than to say that there's something wrong with prizes. There might be something wrong with the prize offerer.
Well, I would agree. But
okay.
my concern currently is, as I see a prize, I see it in terms of the prizes and prize offerers that I've surveyed over the past 12, 15 years associated with...
You see a bunch of implementational details that haven't been, to your mind, particularly desirable or acceptable. So maybe there need to be terms in which things are defined so that... the funds, the proceeds, the benefits, etc., go to the right parties. Promotion of the field, promotion of the developed work, things like that, instead of some other kind of political or religious or ideological goal.
So how do you do that practically, William?
I thought it was fairly simple, straightforward. Papers are submitted with intent to compete for the prize, and out of that, a committee selects one.
Certainly.
Simple.
And I think that is a great idea. I'm not opposed to that as an idea of a prize, because I think what comes through that is basically all the concerns that I have, you know, raised with regards to the way these prizes seem to exist independently of the way that you've described them.
Well, that's because it's not something which was endowed in the first place. It's something that somebody else wants to control for their own political purposes.
Certainly.
Or emotional or otherwise. I don't really know exactly what it is that Brigg wants. I will say that I had my own commentary for his complaint or his project upon return from Artificial Life 10. And I forget who it was that really... They gave a solid argument, a really solid argument. But the bottom line is, how do you define it? And, you know, how do you define that you have achieved the open-ended evolution, given that none of us is going to be around when it occurs?
Certainly.
And Brigg had not defined things in such a way that you could answer that question. The fact of the matter is that the answer to the question comes in about 5 billion years. There you are.
But I think as a simulation problem, there is something that Brigg could have distilled, and certainly when I interviewed him, I wanted him to distill that a bit more. And I think
that going to, if he was, he'd have answered that question that was posed at the time for which I rendered my complaint or remark.
Okay.
So, it's that simple. He wasn't going to. He didn't come up with a definition of open-ended sufficient to answer such that one could determine whether or not a prize was awardable. That I understood. I didn't think he was ever going to come up with a definition because he wouldn't be satisfied with, well, we don't have the answer because we're not there yet. And that's the only answer that's possible. In any kind of practical sense. Everything else is computation. Do you believe mathematics? Some people don't. Some people don't believe proofs that apply today, apply 10 years from now.
Certainly. In terms of the A prize, in terms of the other artificial life-related prizes or potential future prizes, how do you instill, and this is a question that I had for the folks associated with the A prize, how do you actually instill this idea of fairness, of community, of actually awarding the prize, of doing these kind of things when these are independent of our community fundamentally? They're created by independent entities. How do you instill those values, and how do you communicate that, particularly to the media? I mean, I make contact with a lot of folk in the media associated with their reporting of specific issues, particularly to try and bring in the artificial life community, because the issues that they raise are fundamentally about the artificial life community. If you were to see a prize that was coming out in the future that had a certain amount of money associated with it, that went on for a number of years and promoted a particular company or a particular ideological interest, but the prize was never awarded, how do we deal with that as a community?
Well, you can't really control what other people do. I'm not for laws regarding morality. Even ethics are a little bit difficult. I've watched courts, you know, violate laws and do it with impunity, so I'm not impressed by any of it.
So here's my question back to you. Is the prize the thing that is broken? Should we look for things other than prizes to avoid these kind of situations?
I don't think the prize is broken. I think what is broken is the terms under which it is accepted, perhaps. I don't know the particulars regarding Brigg Kleiss's association with A-Life, other than he showed up at A-Life 10 and made his sales pitch. And it was an interesting pitch. He has an interesting problem. It's somewhat well-defined, but he doesn't have, you know, terms of acceptance of demonstration, and that's the basis for awarding of his prize. So, you know, it's a red herring.
But irrespective of Brigg, how many of these flawed prizes do you have to observe where the award money isn't awarded, where basically they're not actively promoting the artificial life community, where they're promoting their own interests before you
so
say
you
that
don't
the prize is broken.
So you tell them to go away or so forth? Well, I've always heard caveat emptor. And in fact, generally that's the way I've been treated in any association I've ever been involved with. Whether it's a state university, a society, everything is like that. And
why don't we construct something that's better than that? Why don't we construct something intellectually which isn't associated with all this polluted methodology and actually strengthen a community in the process?
I'd be all for it. Why don't we? I'm still waiting for the telephone call from my sales, executive board.
Well, maybe I made my pitch,
and the suggestion was that they'd get back to me. I wanted, what do I have to do? Get on my knees and beg? Come on.
Well, that's what I do.
You beg. I wouldn't beg.
Bruce.
Hell no. Look, you've got to be stronger than that. You got to stand up and tell them where they're wrong and let them, push them to get on their knees and beg. That's what they ought to do. It's really simple. I made my pitch. I told, you want to know who it is? I told Jordan Pollock that I'd be interested in this. He said he'd bring it before the board. I presume that he did so. I have no reason to believe that Jordan Pollock didn't take my suggestion at face value, at heart, and I got no ulterior motive. I'm just interested in seeing something, someplace get promoted a little bit.
Certainly, and I think we all are, without question. I mean, that's Bruce clearly is as well. But the way in which
don't like John Maynard Smith. I don't know. That's what I want to name the prize after, for development, because he was the one who complained. It's in the paper. It's in Computational Ontogeny. I quote the issue.
Certainly.
And I think that he's the right one to name it after. If nothing, then to mock. Come on, let's have fun.
Certainly.
I've yet to hear from him. I don't know what they want.
Well, to think of them as a coherent entity, I think, is probably somewhat artificially...
Then they shouldn't have a... what do they call that? A monolithic face. Don't get out the shield, ISIL, and stand behind it if you're not.
Certainly. What has happened recently with ISIL is that they've had not as good an elections as I would want to see. I've given feedback to Mark Badeau about that accordingly, but they have had some elections. The ISIL board has changed. A lot of the folks who were involved in Artificial Life 11 are on the board, some of whom I've worked with, and I have good hopes with regards to the future of the International Society. Mark Badeau, as the chair, has basically similar criticisms to what you're saying, and he is the chair. I think what they're trying to do currently is work through the prior history into something that will more actively and more democratically represent the artificial life community, and certainly we all have to agree that that is basically the way forward and participate actively in that regard.
Agree. Boy, you got a lot of expectations of me, I'll tell you.
So, Bruce, as someone who is entering, you're not a member of the International Society, are you, Bruce?
I'm not a member of any club that would have me as a member. So.
But as you observe this discussion, is it also as you have a kind of historical legacy with regards to certain components of the International Society Board? I mean, they're now allowing you to do a track to ALIFE 12. So, I mean, we have some ends with regards to both my end, the begging, groveling end, and Bruce's end with regards to actually doing stuff. What's your sense with regards to the future of the International Society? And do you think that William's concerns will probably be resolved in the near future?
Well, I think in any of these organizations, you have to be very careful that you don't create an initial negative reaction. So, for example, I tiptoe into these communities. I find out what the interests of the people are in the communities. Try to do something that would be of interest to them or to speak their language. And it may take some time, And then, like, for instance, with Steen and the Evil Grid, Steen really helped to crystallize what the Evil Grid is. And then I went around and met, you know, a dozen other people who helped, who put their input, and they became advisors to the project. And I think that it's kind of it's not only an way to ingratiate yourself with a community and then become part of it, but to be very non-threatening and not come in with a hard opinion. But involve, be very inclusive and involve a lot of people, make them feel like they have ownership of what, who you are and what you are. Because frankly, you know, I can't put a university on my business card. I'm working on a PhD, but I don't have one yet. I don't have a list of published papers in journals that they would recognize. So I'm coming in, as usual, somebody with very little that they would recognize as somebody as a colleague or as a peer. I'm a peer. I'm doing similar work in other fields, which I can present, like the work in the space field. So you have to really, really be careful, and you have to really take the time and do that kind of thing. You just cannot push your way in, and maybe Brig experience some of the pushback. Academics also can flip into critic mode, and I know, Tom, you probably have seen this happen, especially when being raised in an academic family with your father. When the academics start criticizing each other, they can be quite vicious and quite unfair and characterize someone and sort of tar and feather them. And I'm ever concerned about being considered flaky because they can flip on the flaky switch so quickly. So if you want to be in that community and have the resources of that community and the intellectual energies of that community, you have to really understand all that and come in a way that will work. You just can't come in professing a whole approach to things that without connecting with them first and then involving them.
But to be fair to the artificial life academic community, I mean, what you're describing is really a minority of the experiences that I have had, and certainly also, when academics reach out to me or when I reach out to academics, they have an immense sense of respect, which I think we could all get in terms of what we do as an artificial life community is independent from academia. I mean, I write papers and they're published on occasion. And I think there's an immense sense of respect with regards to what we do independently of whether we have PhDs or attached to. And this is really what came through Steen in particular, that he was fascinated about your existence in the real world as opposed to the academic world, Bruce.
Yeah, and certainly he recognized things. You know, I can go and get grant funds from NASA and whatnot and have avatar background and everything because I'm a kind of a polyglot. I go around and I absorb a field. I help start a couple of little subfields, and I bounce around between academia and industry and users and artists and, you know, you name it, in 50 different fields because virtual worlds intersected everything from art, you know, anthropology to architecture. So I travel in all these worlds, but I think I'm effective because I really try to listen and I try to internalize and do my ethnography and become kind of a part of the mindset of the community that I'm in. If I was at a conference or Galen and I are doing a keynote, we don't know anything about the subject. We absorb it and we talk to a million people or dozens of people for a few days and then really be able to talk their language. And then we'll go off to another conference and do that. And so in a sense, I now have the ability to sort of be in these different communities. And but initially I was very nervous about meeting Steen. But it went very well, and I'm grateful for that, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to work on A-Life 12.
So concluding this topic, if there can be a conclusion, I wanted to talk a little bit about Dick Gordon and your connection with Dick Gordon, William, particularly in terms of the near future. You're planning on going and studying under Dick. You're working on topics. This introduction into kind of formalized academia. It's funny because I met Dick recently, and it was a real privilege to even spend a brief amount of time with Dick. Ironically, we probably talk more on Bios Alive, but the thing that he passed on to me is that we are all outsiders, that we should all, irrespective of whether we're in academia or independent from academia, by pushing the boundaries, by having this kind of discourse, we are immediately outsiders, and we need to embrace almost this kind of shared outside that we all are a part of. What are you planning on doing in the future with Dick, and how do you see this kind of unfolding over the next few years, William?
Well, that I'm giving a lot of consideration to. The exact time frame will probably be on the longer end. I'm going to say it'll take me 7 years to complete the PhD, and that's from today. The goals are largely in the hand of Richard as far as what the project is, because I'm not a biologist. I don't have enough background to know what would be suitable topics in detail. But I think that in general it will have something to do with the control networks, genetic regulatory networks, and some, what I'm thinking is a parallel between the cell cycle of prokaryotes and development in metazoans. I've been doing some research, reading some papers, found an interesting one on PNAS that has to do with stability, the retention of phenotypic traits in spite of variation in genotype, and found it interesting as to why there is stability, and apparently it has something to do with the overall complexity of the regulatory network. I'm a little bit concerned with some complaints I've heard from other biologists that the regulatory network is pretty much like spaghetti code. And I would hope that that's not the case. I'd like to find some kind of hierarchical structure. And that is a central theme of Richard's work and part of the title of one of his books, I guess is his opus. It's going to be interesting finding, you know, the particular project. It will probably center on development of his current model organism, which is the axolotl, although I found another one that I think is really interesting called the acetabularia. It's some kind of very large single-celled organism that you can hold in your hand. You can actually see it.
Gosh.
I learned about that from a gentleman named Mark Wilkinson, who does heart research in British Columbia, I believe it is, but he came and was one of the instructors for the applied genomics course, computational genomics course, about a week and a half ago in Montreal. So I've been preparing, getting familiar with some other people in the field, trying to establish a meeting with Richard in Winnipeg, which I hope will be sometime at the end of this month, and kind of cleaning up on my Gecko 2009 activities.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I mean, do keep us updated on BiosLive, because, I mean, I think Dick certainly is an active participant in the community and an active motivator with regards to a number of different directions, and certainly it was a real pleasure to meet him and Natalie, and also their two dogs, which dogs are the things that always, when you describe the idea of the spread genotype but the similar phenotype, I always think of dogs in that regard. And certainly Dick had two opposite ends of the spectrum dogs that he brought with him when he came to visit Las Vegas. So I'd like to thank you both, and also Eric Burton, for participating in this evening's BIOS Live. We've covered a wide variety of topics, some good, strong discussion. It's always a pleasure to have you on, William, in particular, to inspire that kind of discussion. And Bruce, you've been the ever-present peacemaker as always. So I'd like to thank you both, and Eric, for participating this evening. Our topic for the next Biota Live on September 18th at 8 p.m. Pacific, many great projects actually embracing the diversity of artificial life projects that exist currently. I was looking at the Wikipedia entry of artificial life, and someone had attached dates associated with various projects that were fundamentally wrong. I think there are a number of projects out there. There are still semi-active. I know a few folk in the artificial life community have had children recently, and that's kind of slowed down their projects, but they're certainly out there. Certainly folks can get involved and get developed, and I wanted to highlight some of those projects in the next Biota Live. So thank you both very much for participating. Thanks to Eric Burton as well, and thanks to everyone for listening. Good night.
Ciao.
Thank you.
Tom, I have a configuration that I want to send to you that you can run on Gali, but I want to know if you actually have the tool.
I have not. Okay, so let me pick you up.
Will you get Gali and stop lollygagging?
Oh, look, my lollygagging is associated with moving a huge amount of source code from Steve Grand and Jeffrey Ventrella open source, which is just a phenomenal effort in terms of both. But the stuff that Brutes has been talking about in terms of kind of casually moving folks who are, being introduced to open source, plus Intel developing Noble 8, plus additional Noble 8 development, plus working 10-plus hours a day at a day job. So please excuse my inability to install Gali at this exact moment. Oh, I'm also writing 4 chapters for 2 separate books currently, too. So,
well, see, that'll teach you to not ask me to write one of those chapters.
Oh, you will be asked to write one of those chapters in the future. The purpose of both of them is actually to get publishers to sign off on the 2 separate topics, and you will certainly be asked to write in one of them, if not both.